You will expect no trouble from me until such time as Jane leaves Thornfield for good. After that, we negotiate.
I won't negotiate, Hades.
Hades shook his head slowly.
You'll negotiate, Miss Next.
You may be disgustingly righteous, but even you will balk at spending the rest of your life in here. You're an intelligent woman. I'm sure you'll think of something.
I sighed and walked back outside, where the bustle of the shoppers and traders was a welcome break from the dark soul of Hades.
Chapter 33. The Book is Written. From our position in the lounge of the Pendron Hotel, we could see Thursday's good work. The narrative continued rapidly. Weeks passed in the space of a few lines. As the words wrote themselves back across the page, they were read aloud by Mycroft or myself. We were all waiting for the phrase "sweet madness" to appear in the text, but it didn't. We prepared ourselves to assume the worst, that Hades was not caught and might never be, that Thursday might stay in the book as some sort of permanent caretaker. From Bowden Cable's Journal. The weeks passed rapidly at Thornfield, and I busied myself with the task of making Jane secure without her ever knowing it. I had a young lad positioned at the Millcote to warn of Hades' movements, but he seemed quite happy just to go out walking every morning, borrow books from the local doctor, and spend his time at the inn. His inaction was a cause of some worry, but I was glad it was merely that for the time being. Rochester had sent a note advising of his return, and a party was arranged for local friends of his. Jane seemed to be severely agitated by the arrival of the airhead Blanche Ingram, but I gave it little heed. I was busy trying to arrange security with John, the cook's husband, who was a resourceful and intelligent man. I had taught him to shoot with Rochester's pistols, and he was, I was delighted to find out, an excellent shot. I had thought that Hades might make an appearance with one of the guests, but, apart from the arrival of Mr. Mason from the West Indies, nothing out of the ordinary occurred. The weeks turned into months, and I saw little of Jane, on purpose, of course, but kept in contact with the household and Mr. Rochester to make sure that all was going well. And it appeared that all was going well. As usual, Mr. Mason was bitten by his mad sister in the upper room. I was standing outside the locked door when Rochester went for the doctor and Jane tended to Mason's wounds. When the doctor arrived, I kept watch in the arbour outside, where I knew Jane and Rochester would meet. And so it went on until a brief respite, when Jane went away to visit her dying aunt in Gateshead. Rochester had decided to marry Blanche Ingram by this time, and things had been slightly tense between him and Jane. I felt some relief that she was away. I could relax and talk to Rochester quite easily, without Jane suspecting anything.
"You aren't sleeping," observed Rochester, as we walked together on the front lawn. "Look how your eyes are dark-rimmed and languorous."
"I don't sleep well here, not while Hades is barely 5 miles distant."
"Your spies surely would alert you to any movement of his."
It was true, the network worked well, although not without some considerable expenditure on Rochester's part. If Hades set off anywhere, I knew about it within 2 minutes from a rider who stood by for just such an occasion. It was in this manner that I was able to find him when he was out, either walking or reading or beating peasants with his stick. He had never come within a mile of the house, and I was happy to keep it that way.
"My spies afford me peace of mind, but I still can't believe that Hades could be so passive. It chills and worries me."
We walked on for a while, Rochester pointing out places of interest to me around the grounds, but I was not listening.
"How did you come to me that night outside the warehouse, when I was shot?"
Rochester stopped and looked at me.
"It just happened, Miss Next. I can't explain it any more than you can explain arriving here when you were a little girl. Apart from Mrs. Nakajima and a traveller named Foyle, I don't know of anyone else who has done it."
I was surprised at this.
"You've met Mrs. Nakajima, then?"
"Of course. I usually do tours of Thornfield for her guests when Jane is up at Gateshead. It carries no risk and is extremely lucrative. Country houses are not cheap to run, Miss Next, even in this century."
I allowed myself a smile. I thought that Mrs. Nakajima must be making a very sizable profit. It was, after all, the ultimate trip for a Bronte fan, and there were plenty of those in Japan.
"What will you do after this?"
asked Rochester, pointing out a rabbit to Pilot, who barked and ran off.
"Back to spec ops work, I guess," I replied. "What about you?"
Rochester looked at me broodingly, his eyebrows furrowed and a look of anger rising across his features.
"There is nothing for me after Jane leaves with that slimy and pathetic excuse for a vertebrate, St. John Rivers."
"So what will you do?"
"Do? I won't do anything. Existence pretty much ceases for me about then."
"Death?"
"Not as such," replied Rochester, choosing his words carefully. "Where you come from, you are born, you live, and then you die. Am I correct?"
"More or less."
"A pretty poor way of living, I should imagine," laughed Rochester. "And you rely upon that inward eye we call a memory to sustain yourself in times of depression, I suppose."
"Most of the time," I replied, "although memory is but 1/100th of the strength of currently felt emotions."
"I concur. Here, I neither am born nor die. I come into being at the age of 38 and wink out again soon after, having fallen in love for the first time in my life and then lost the object of my adoration, my being."
He stopped and picked up the stick that Pilot had considerately brought him in place of the rabbit he couldn't catch.
"You see, I can move myself to anywhere in the book I wish at a moment's notice and back again at will. The greatest parts of my life lie between the time I profess my true love to that fine impish girl and the moment the lawyer and that fool Mason turn up to spoil my wedding and reveal the madwoman in the attic. Those are the weeks to which I return most often. But I go to the bad times too, for without a yardstick sometimes the high points can be taken for granted. Sometimes I muse that I might have John stop them at the church gate and stall them until the wedding is over, but it is against the way of things.
So while I am talking to you here, I am also meeting Jane for the first time, wooing her, then losing her forever. I can even see you now as a small child, your expression of fear under the hooves of my horse." He felt his elbow.
"And feel the pain of the fall, too. So, you see, my existence, although limited, is not without benefits."
I sighed. "If only life were that simple, if one could jump to the good parts and flick through the bad."
"You have a man you love?" asked Rochester suddenly.
"Yes, but there is much bad air between us. He accused my brother of a crime that I thought unfair to lay upon the shoulders of a dead man. My brother never had a chance to defend himself, and the evidence was not strong. I find it hard to forgive."
"What is there to forgive?" demanded Rochester. "Ignore forgive and concentrate on living. Life for you is short, far too short to allow small jealousies to infringe on the happiness which can be yours only for the briefest of times."
"Alas," I countered, "he is engaged to be married."
"And what of that?" scoffed Rochester. "Probably to someone as unsuitable for him as Blanche Ingram is for me."
I thought about Daisy Mutler, and there did indeed seem to be a strong similarity. We walked along together in silence, until Rochester pulled out a pocket watch and consulted it.
"My Jane is returning from Gateshead as we speak. Where is my pencil and notebook?"
He rummaged within his jacket and produced a bound drawing book and a pencil.
"I am to meet her as if by accident. She walks across the field shortly in this direction. How do I look?"
I straightened his necktie and nodded my satisfaction.
"Do you think me handsome, Miss Next?" he asked quite suddenly.
"No,"
I answered truthfully. "Bah!" exclaimed Rochester. "Pixies both. Begone with you. We will talk later."
I left them to it, and walked back to the house by way of the lake, deep in thought.
And so the weeks wore on, the air becoming warmer, and the buds starting to shoot on the trees. I hardly saw anything of Rochester or Jane, as they had eyes only for each other. Mrs. Fairfax was not highly impressed by the union, but I told her not to be so unreasonable. She flustered like an old hen at this remark, and went about her business. The routine of Thornfield didn't waver from normalcy for the next few months. The season moved into summer, and I was there on the day of the wedding, invited specifically by Rochester, and hidden in the vestry. I saw the clergyman, a large man named Mr. Wood, ask whether anyone knew of an impediment that might prevent the wedding being lawful or joined by God. I heard the solicitor call out his terrible secret.
Rochester, I could see, was beside himself with rage as Briggs read out the affidavit from Mason to declare that the madwoman was Bertha Rochester, Mason's sister, and Rochester's legal wife. I remained in hiding as the argument ensued, emerging only when the small group was led over to the house by Rochester to meet his mad wife. I didn't follow. I went for a walk, breathing in the fresh air and avoiding the sadness and anguish in the house as Rochester and Jane realized they could not marry. By the following day, Jane was gone. I followed at a safe distance to see her take the road to Whitcross, looking like a small stray searching for a better life elsewhere. I watched her until she was out of sight, and then walked into Millcote for lunch. Once I had finished my meal at the George, I played cards with three travelling gamblers. By supper time, I had taken 6 guineas off them. As I played, a small boy appeared at our table. "Hello, William," I said. "What news?" I bent down to the height of the waif, who was dressed in adult-sized hand-me-downs that had been sewn up to fit.
"Begging your pardon, Miss Next, but Mr. Edge has vanished."
I leapt up in some alarm, broke into a run, and didn't stop until I arrived at the Millcote. I flew upstairs to the landing, where one of my most trusted spies was tugging at his flat cap nervously. Hades' room was empty.
"I'm sorry, miss. I was in the bar downstairs. Not drinking, mind, I swear to it. You must have slipped past me."
"Did anyone else come down the stairs, Daniel? Tell me quick."
"No one. No one save the old lady."
I took the horse from one of my riders and was at Thornfield in double quick time. Neither of the guards at the doors had seen anything of Hades. I entered and found Edward in the morning room, toasting himself from a bottle of brandy. He raised his glass as I entered.
"She's gone, hasn't she?" he asked.
"She has."
"Damnation! Curse the circumstances that allowed me to be trapped into the wedding with that half-wit, and curse my brother and father for entreating such a union."
He fell into a chair and stared at the floor.
"Your work is done here?"
he asked me resignedly. "I think so, yes. I have only to find Hades and I can be off."
"Is he not at the Millcote?"
"Not any longer."
"But do you expect to capture him?"
"I do. He seems weakened here."
"Then you had better tell me your password. Time may not be on our side when the moment comes. Forewarned is forearmed."
"True," I conceded. "To open the door you have to say..." But at that moment the front door slammed, a gust of wind disturbed some papers, and a familiar footfall rang out on the tiles in the hall. I froze and looked across at Rochester, who was staring into his glass.
"The code word?"
I heard a voice calling to Pilate. It had the deep bass resonance of the master of the house.
"Blast!"
murmured Hades, as he melted from his disguise as Rochester and leapt at the wall in a flash, bursting through the lath and plaster as though it were rice paper. By the time I had made my way to the hallway outside, he had gone, vanished somewhere deep into the house. Rochester joined me as I listened intently up the stairs, but no sound reached us. Edward guessed what had happened and quickly mustered his estate workers. Within 20 minutes he had them guarding the outside of the house under strict orders to fire upon anyone who tried to escape without giving a prearranged password. This done, we returned to the library and Rochester drew out a set of pistols and loaded each carefully. He looked uneasily at my Browning automatic as he placed 2 percussion caps atop the nipples of the pistols and replaced the hammers.
"Bullets just make him mad," I told him.
"You have a better idea?"
I said nothing.
"Then you had better follow me. The sooner this menace is out of my book, the better."
All except Grace Poole and the madwoman had been removed from the house, and Mrs. Poole had been entreated not to open the door to anyone until the morning, on any account, not even to Mr. Rochester. Rochester and I started at the library and moved through to the dining room and then the afternoon reception room. After this, we searched the morning reception room and then the ballroom. All were empty. We returned to the staircase where we had placed John and Matthew, who both swore no one had passed them. Night had descended by this time. The men who stood guard had been given torches, and their meagre light flickered in the hall. The stairs and panelling of the house were of a dark wood, which reflected light poorly. The belly of a whale would have been brighter. We reached the top of the stairs and looked left and right, but the house was dark, and I cursed myself for not bringing a good flashlight.
As if in answer to my thoughts, a gust of wind blew out the candles, and somewhere ahead